The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
And when you realize that the Supreme Court justices are chosen for life, and the only ruler they have is the Constitution. If they don't believe in the Constitution, they just don't have any rule, and they have a lot of power, and they can become a kind of a tyrant. That's how serious this is.
That's from my father's Key of David program 7 years ago, talking about the supreme law of the land, how that the Constitution has final say. And if it doesn't, well, you're not going to have any rule. You're just going to have a lot of human beings with a lot of power, or rather a few human beings at the very top. Judges 21 and verse 25 says about ancient Israel, there was no authority from the top. There was no final say, absolute law. And so everyone was off doing what seemed right in their own eyes. Yesterday I read that quote from Robert Bork. He said, the truth is that the judge who looks outside the Constitution always looks inside himself and nowhere else. He just judges according to what seems right in his mind, in his eyes. There's a proverb that says, there's a way which seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. It's interesting when you look back at that history with Robert Bork. Of course, we've talked a lot this week about the death of Justice Scalia. But if you go back to Robert Bork's nomination in 1987, and just how strong the resistance was to him after Scalia got through the year before, and then when Bork came around the next year, Joe Biden and others, Kennedy, they went on the attack. Within minutes of the announcement, this is what Bork said about that ugly process from 1987. He wrote this in his book, Tempting of America. He said, the clash over my nomination was simply one battle in this long-running war for control of our legal culture. There may be legitimate differences about the nomination, but in the larger war for control of the law, there are only two sides. Either the Constitution and statutes are law, which means that their principles are known and control judges, or they are malleable texts that judges may rewrite to see that particular groups or political causes win. It says, until recently, the American people were largely unaware of the struggle for dominance in law because it was waged in explicit form only in law schools. Now it's coming into the open. But as he brings out there, it's either the Constitution rules over judges or judges rule over the Constitution. Judges can come in and rewrite the Constitution to satisfy particular groups or political causes. And so Bork came along as a strict constitutionalist, just like Scalia. Here he was, a former Marine, a law graduate from the University of Chicago, a professor at Yale Law School. He served as U.S. Solicitor General. He was confirmed by the Senate as an appellate judge in 1982. The American Bar Association said he was exceptionally well qualified. It gave Bork their highest rating, that from the ABA. But as soon as President Reagan announced his intention to nominate Bork in 1987 to the Supreme Court, well, within minutes, as I say, there were many liberals who believe in an evolving constitution. Many liberals who jumped forward to denounce Bork on national television. And the one who presided over the hearing for Bork was the current Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden. And he was so publicly outspoken against Bork's nomination. The Judiciary Committee rejected it 9-5. And so it was all leading to a Senate vote that was certainly going to reject him. And this is what Bork said in 1987. He said, "In the 100 days since my nomination, the country has witnessed an unprecedented event. The process of confirming justices for our nation's highest court has been transformed in a way that should not and indeed must not be permitted to occur again. The tactics and techniques of national political campaigns have been unleashed on the process of confirming judges. That's not simply disturbing, it's dangerous. Federal judges are not appointed to decide cases according to the latest opinion polls. They're appointed to decide cases impartially according to the law. But when judicial nominees are assessed and treated like political candidates, the effect will be to chill the climate in which judicial deliberations take place, to erode public confidence in the impartiality of courts, and to endanger the independence of the judiciary." He concluded, "In 200 years, no nominee for justice has ever campaigned for that high office. None ever should, and I will not. It's not a political campaign. It's whether or not he'll come in and abide by the law and uphold the law, the rule of law, and defend the Constitution." Well, these days, if you do that, there's no way you're going to end up on the Supreme Court. The last originalist to get through was in 2006, Sam Alito. Notice what then Senator Obama said. This was in 2006 on why he voted no for the Sam Alito nomination.
"There are some who believe that the president, having won the election, should have complete authority to appoint his nominee, and the Senate should only examine whether or not the justice is intellectually capable and an all-around good guy. That once you get beyond intellect and personal character, there should be no further questions as to whether the judge should be confirmed. I disagree with this view. I believe firmly that the Constitution calls for the Senate to advise and consent. I believe that it calls for meaningful advice and consent that includes an examination of a judge's philosophy, ideology, and record. And when I examine the philosophy, ideology, and record of Samuel Alito, I am deeply troubled."
Of course, the Constitution does say that the Senate should advise and consent. But he believed firmly back then that the senator should consider the judge's ideology and his philosophy. Notice what else he said. This was from the same speech he gave in the Senate in 2006.
"Judge Alito consistently sides with the notion that a president should not be constrained by either congressional acts or the check of the judiciary. He believes in the overarching power of the president to engage in whatever policies the president deems to be appropriate.
So Alito should be prevented from becoming a Supreme Court justice because he was one that wanted to give the president, in this case President Bush, unlimited power. Alito supposedly was a believer in the overarching power of the president. Isn't that interesting to hear Barack Obama, who is now president and who is going to great lengths to bypass Congress, to bypass the Supreme Court, to exercise his increasing overarching power as president? There was a hearing in Congress in 2012, a House Judiciary Committee that heard testimony from a panel of experts. This is right in Congress, who testified that as president, Barack Obama has made a habit of bypassing or ignoring constitutional limitations. He's just made a habit of it. One senator said, we can't ignore abuses of power because if we ignore them, they become part of established practice and tradition. You just get used to it. It's like Bork said about the nomination clash in 1987. How many would look at the Supreme Court today as an impartial, a group of judges, just judges, that were there to just rule according to the law? It just depends on what side you're on. You see it as one side is this political wing and the other side is this political wing. It's just as Bork said it would be. This push, this movement to undermine the Constitution. You've heard all the statements from the current president. I urge the Congress to act. I urge them to do this. If they don't, I'll do it myself. I'll exercise the overarching power of the presidency. Yesterday I told you about his views on the Constitution itself, just the negative take that he has on that. Listen to what, again, Senator Obama told George Stephanopoulos in an interview. This is also from 2006, and this is after Stephanopoulos asked him, this was about the Alito nomination. He said, two of your colleagues, Senator Kennedy and Senator Kerry, want to try to mount a filibuster tomorrow. Will you join them? And this was Senator Obama's response.
I will be supporting the filibuster because I think Judge Alito, in fact, is somebody who is contrary to core American values, not just liberal values.
Not just liberal values, but just the core American values. Judge Alito's thinking runs contrary to that. And so he voted against it. He even joined on to try to filibuster the nomination hearing to try to prevent it from going forward. And now Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Secretary Kerry, Hillary Clinton, you can add them all into the mix. So many of these now most prominent voices coming from the left wing, they're going to be jumping forward in the days and weeks ahead with cries of injustice for anyone. And of course, this is assuming that Republicans will fight against it. And they probably won't. But if they did, or if some of them do, there will be cries of injustice. You've got to let the president nominate. You've got to vote him through. This is the way the Constitution says it should be done. Now, all of a sudden, you're going to see those from the left wing crying out, we've got to go with the Constitution. Notice what President Obama said yesterday at a press conference in California.
The Constitution is pretty clear about what is supposed to happen now. When there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court, the President of the United States is to nominate someone. The Senate is to consider that nomination and either they disapprove of that nominee or that nominee is elevated to the Supreme Court. Historically, this has not been viewed as a question. There's no unwritten law that says that it can only be done on off years. That's not in the constitutional text. I'm amused when I hear people who claim to be strict interpreters of the Constitution suddenly reading into it a whole series of provisions that are not there. There is more than enough time for the Senate to consider in a thoughtful way the record of a nominee that I present and to make a decision.
So now that he works on the other side of town, in another branch of the government, it's clear what needs to be done here. It sure will be fascinating to watch as this unfolds. What a fight this is going to be. And as we said yesterday, right in the midst of a pretty significant election. Notice what else the president said. This is from that press conference yesterday.
Following up on that, should we interpret your comments just now that you are likely to choose a moderate nominee? Would you consider?
No.
Okay.
I don't know where you found that. You shouldn't assume anything about the qualifications of the nominee other than they're going to be well qualified.
You shouldn't assume that they're going to be moderate. And of course, by that, the questioner meant, is it going to be someone that's not from the left wing, but more in the middle that would please Republicans? No. No, it's going to be someone that's right in line with the other ones we've appointed. We've got an agenda here. We're firm believers in an evolving constitution. We're not going to put someone on the court that's not believing the same thing we are. It's got to be a malleable text, you understand. And so that's what they're going to aim to push through. And you can imagine they're going to use every possible means to get this done. That, as I say, is going to make for a pretty amazing year. One more question that was asked yesterday at the press conference and then the president's response.
And lastly, as long as we're doing this in a row, how do you respond to Republican criticism that your position is undercut by the fact that you and other members of your administration who were in the Senate at the time tried to filibuster Judge Alito in 2006?
You know, look, I think what's fair to say is that how judicial nominations have evolved over time is not historically the fault of any single party. This has become just one more extension of politics. And there are times where folks are in the Senate and they're thinking, as I just described, primarily about, is this going to cause me problems in a primary? Is this going to cause me problems with supporters of mine? And so people take strategic decisions. I understand that.
So that's basically the president all but admitting that he filibustered Alito for political reasons. He was in the Senate. He had to think about politics. He had to think about re-election campaigns. And so it was kind of obvious that he had to step up and make that move in 2006. But now, as I say, now that the tables are turned, you can bet, of course, that there will be cries of injustice and left-wingers that now all of a sudden hold up the Constitution. This is where we are because of what Bork said, because of what's happened over the last two generations, because of what my father addressed in that 2009 Key of David program. This is where we are after years and years of attacks against the supreme law of the land. And how much worse will it get, as I was saying yesterday, when you replace the seat of Justice Scalia with someone who's, well, who's not near as much of an originalist as he was? From the sound of it, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday even, you had some in the conservative wing that were really coming out strong saying they're not going to push this through. And already, you can see in the New York Times today, already they're beginning to back away from it. Senator Grassley, a Republican, he said, I think the quote here is in this story from the New York Times, he's indicated some leeway, the report says, although he still believes the next president ought to name Justice Scalia's replacement. Quote, I would wait until the nominee is made before I would make any decisions. The article here points to another Republican, Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who said the Republicans didn't want to be seen as being an obstructionist. And so they're probably going to hear out the administration. And then what happens from there? What happens if they vote it down? What about a recess appointment? There's all kinds of things that could unfold. But as I was saying yesterday, the overarching point that we can make, and you can base this on numerous prophecies and on booklets like No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack, you can know that the radical swing to the anti-law left, it will continue. It will continue, just as it has in the White House, just as it has in Congress, just as it has in the Supreme Court. Look at the decision they made last June on same-sex marriage, even with Scalia as a sitting justice. What a dangerous direction the United States is headed in. Let me take you back to that program that my father gave. This is from May 10th, 2009, so almost 7 years ago. Here's what he said on the Key of David.
History is full of examples of failure of empires and great nations to establish the rule of law. It's a very difficult thing to do. Now we have America as a superpower, and I think if you look around, you'd have to say we're losing our grip on the law. And the supreme law of this land is the Constitution. And to a great extent, originally that was established on God's law. Many biblical principles were used to found that law. And then, of course, we even used principles from the British Magna Carta. So we built that on a real strong foundation. And yet we see many people coming along today attacking that Constitution and trying to tear it down. What does that all mean?
What does it mean? What happens when you have many of the most prominent leaders in the land attacking the Constitution instead of building it up, instead of reinforcing it? They're attacking it. They're saying, prominent voices are saying we need to do away with it. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's on the court, as I said yesterday, she said in 2012, if she were writing a new constitution for a newly formed nation, she wouldn't use the U.S. Constitution. She'd use something else. Some other document. My father went on to say this.
When you look around at our country, do you think there are masses of people that are willing to die, just let their blood flow as a river of blood, if necessary, to preserve that Constitution. Well, I believe you're going to have to say, well, now, wait a minute. I don't think we have people that are willing to do that and understand it deeply enough and love it deeply enough to die for it. That is what we need to think about, because if we lose that foundational law, we are in serious trouble. Our forefathers were prepared to die and had their blood flow to establish that Constitution. You've read that history. You know about that history. Many of them died to establish that freedom, this rule of law that gave them freedom and many other blessings. How many people would die for our Constitution today?
How many would die for the supreme law in the land today? How many would die for that document, that legal document? Instead, as I covered yesterday, it's the document itself, the Constitution itself, that's dying. In 1954, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, Earl Warren, he wrote, "I believe the entire Bill of Rights came into being because of the knowledge our forefathers had of the Bible and their belief in it." That's just what my father was saying there. It's because of the forefathers' belief in the Bible. That's a Supreme Court justice from just, what, 60 years ago. Today, you have a huge ruling on marriage, and there's no mention of God, save in Justice Thomas's dissent. But nothing in there in the majority opinion. As I read to you yesterday, you have paraphrases from Confucius, but nothing about what God thinks about marriage. What's God's definition? I mean, he's the one who made it. He's the one who instituted it. I believe the entire Bill of Rights came into being because of the knowledge of our forefathers, or rather that our forefathers had, of the Bible and their belief in it. This is from Joseph Story, another Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Scalia referred to him in his dissent on that same sex marriage ruling last June. Story said, "The reader must not expect to find in these pages," speaking of the Constitution, "the reader must not expect to find in these pages any novel views and novel constructions of the Constitution. I have not the ambition to be the author of any new plan of interpreting the theory of the Constitution or of enlarging or narrowing its powers by ingenious subtleties and learned doubts. That's not what I'm here to do." He was there to uphold the rule of law. That's what every just judge does. Upholds the rule of law. One final clip from my father's program in May 2009.
"The law is preeminent. Either you rule by the law, or you rule by a person or a class of people, or by brute force."
It's either the law or it's a human being. If, as I said yesterday, if we as a people, we don't obey the rule of law, then we'll fall victim to the rule of man. That's what's happened. Let's just notice a few verses. This is Habakkuk. The prophet Habakkuk, chapter 1, and verse 1, it says, "The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see, O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear, even cry out unto you of violence, and you will not save?" There was a crisis in Habakkuk's day. And notice what it revolved around. Verse 3, "Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that raise up strife and contention," as my father's explained in his writings. You can look at those two words, strife and contention, and see that it's talking about a legal struggle. And that theme continues in through the next verse, verse 4, therefore the law is slacked, and judgment does never go forth. For the wicked does compass about the righteous, therefore wrong judgment proceeds. The law is slacked. Judgment's not going forth. The righteous are surrounded by the wicked. Lang's commentary says the meaning would be there's no more any righteous verdict given. The Anchor Bible talks about the judicial language here being unmistakable. Corruption in the courts. That's what we'll see in the latter days. That's what we're seeing in these latter days. The prophet Micah, he says, and I said, this is in Micah 3 and verse 1, and I said, here I pray you, O heads of Jacob, and you princes of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know judgment? I mean, judges are supposed to know the law. They're supposed to interpret and enforce it. They're supposed to be just in their judgment, unbiased, based on the rule of law. My father says in the booklet he has on the prophet Micah, he says this is addressed to the heads, magistrates, and government officials responsible for upholding the law. Their responsibility is to give us justice based on law. It has to be based on law if it's going to hold together. The framers certainly understood this when they established the law of the land. Finally, Micah 6 and verse 8, it says, he has showed you, O man, what is good, and what does the Eternal require of you, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. That's what God requires of our leaders. That's what he requires of judges. To do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly before God. Notice the principles that Micah brings out in his book, in his writing. My father said in that Key of David program, the one I've played a few clips from, that you get away from this. You get away from the rule of law, and you're going to lose everything. That's how he concluded that show, which played on May 10th, 2009. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, the headquarters campus. We're broadcasting from Edstone in the UK, the beautiful Midlands. Here in Britain, it's made possible through the live stream, back to our headquarters campus, and then out to you, our beloved listeners. Keep sending us those emails. We've gotten a number of really great responses over the last several days. Email us at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. the Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
When the American founding fathers, the framers, wrote the Constitution, they intended to prevent the common abuses of rule among nations and kingdoms by carefully defining and restricting activities and powers of all three branches of government. The highest authority of the land, towering above those three branches, towering above every government official, whether elected or appointed, was the United States Constitution. That's the way it was then. That's not the way it is today. Sadly, that's not the way it is today. The law, the supreme law, does not tower above those branches of government. It's evolving. It's changing. It's being watered down. It's being liberalized. And as my father said in the program from 7 years ago, you get away from the law and you lose everything. Let's just conclude with what time we have left by going through a few more basic scriptures. Deuteronomy chapter 17. The supreme law concept, of course, is firmly rooted in the Bible, the Holy Bible. It's spelled out here in Deuteronomy 17. This is where God outlines the duties of a king, a leader, a ruler. He says in verse 14, when you are come into the land which the Eternal your God gives you, and shall possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shall say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me. You shall in any wise set him king over you, whom the Lord your God shall choose. One from among your brethren shall you set king over you. You may not set a stranger over you, which is not your brother, but he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Eternal has said unto you, you shall henceforth return no more that way. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. He can't rule selfishly, in other words. He can't be in it to serve himself. He's got to serve God. He's got to serve the people. Verse 18, and it shall be when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book, out of that which is before the priest and the Levites. God told the leaders in ancient Israel to write down and read and study the law of God. Imagine if he would have said, look, just keep in mind as you do this that it's going to be ever-changing. It is, after all, a breathing document. And we've got to modernize it. We've got to change with the times. God didn't say that. He said, you copy this law. You write down this law. Now, do you think studying this law is a crucial component to your overall education and training? We need this daily instruction. We've got to be grounded in it. I mean, the sad fact, you can talk about the evolving Constitution all that you want, but the sad truth is that most people, as my father brought out in that program from 2009, most people don't even really know what's in the Constitution. They don't care to study into it. They don't care to look into it. There was a poll, I forget the percentage, but it was shocking, like so many of these polls about our youths, about our young people, about this popular culture. Just a huge number of people that didn't even know Justice Scalia served on the Supreme Court. Just total ignorance. Totally unaware of our government institutions, the laws of the land. What a dangerous, dangerous way to think. To just proceed through life, doing what seems right in your own eyes. Doing what seems right. As it says in Proverbs 14:12, it can seem so right, and yet the end, that's the thing. Where is this going to end? That's what my father was asking in that Key of David program. How is this going to end, this trajectory we're on? With all of these relentless attacks against the law of the land, where is it taking the United States? Well, look at what God said to his leaders in ancient Israel, his kings. Verse 19, and it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes, to do them. See, he couldn't be above the law. He was ruled by the law. And when those leaders veered off course or veered away from this instruction, from these laws, well, they led the people of Israel into one curse after another curse after another curse. How will this end? Where is this leading? It says in verse 20 that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he turn not aside from the commandment, to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children, in the midst of Israel. I mean, this was to be the manner of the king. Above all, his heart, his attitude before God had to be right. He had to fear God. He had to submit to God's laws. God-fearing and humble. And as I say, whenever those Israelite kings stopped doing this, stopped living this way, and viewed the laws of God as ever-changing, as a malleable text, as a living and breathing document that could be modernized from time to time, it brought so many curses on the people of Israel, so much suffering, so much pain. Isaiah chapter 59, I think I might have referred to this on yesterday's program, this chapter. Let's just read through some of these verses. Isaiah 59 and verse 1. It says, behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, neither his ear heavy that it cannot hear. But your iniquities have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hid his face from you, that he will not hear. It's the sins of the people. That's why God hides his face from us. It's because of our own sins. It's not just the sins of a president or a Congress or a group of justices. It's the people. It's the many sins. It's the rampant ignorance. The hostility to God and His laws. Isaiah goes on and says, verse 3, "For your hands are defiled with blood and your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken lies. Your tongue has muttered perverseness. None calls for justice, nor any pleads for truth." I mean, what's the truth? They trust in vanity and speak lies. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity. That's what we have today. It's just vanity. It's just looking within self. It's just satisfying our lustful pulls of the flesh. And that's why we have one crisis after another crisis after another crisis. Because we love ourselves more than we love the law. We love ourselves more than we love the Constitution. We love ourselves more than we love the Bible. We love self more than God. We're so steeped in sin. So steeped in it. And God's far from us because of it. Their feet run to evil, verse 7. And they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity, wasting and destruction are in their paths. That's the course that they're on. And because of it, there's, well, the way of peace, we don't know, verse 8 says. In that same verse, we read this so often, the way of peace, they know not. The very same verse it says, and there's no judgment in their goings. There's no judgment. There's no just rulings. Verse 9 says, therefore is judgment far from us. Neither does justice overtake us. We wait for light, but behold obscurity, for brightness, but we walk in darkness. That's a pretty accurate description of society today. We're waiting for brightness, waiting for light, and yet we carry on in obscurity and darkness. Verse 10, we grope for the wall like the blind, and we grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as in the night. We are in desolate places as dead men. We roar all like bears and mourn sore like doves. We look for judgment, but there is none. For salvation, but it's far off from us. No just judgment in the land. Our transgressions are multiplied, the next verse says, and our sins testify against us. For our transgressions are with us, and as for our iniquities, we know them. Our sins have testified before us. It's because of our sins that just judgment is gone. It's because of sin that there's this all-out assault on supreme law, that law and enforcement of law is now seen as a bad thing. It's a negative thing. That's all that old document did. It just prevented us from certain things. But it didn't tell us what we can do, what things the government should do for you. And I'm here, leaders say, I'm here to show you what your government can do for you. I'm here to tell you what you can't do. It's either submit to the rule of law or submit to the rule of men. Verse 13, in transgressing and lying against the eternal and departing away from our God, speaking oppression and revolt, conceiving and uttering from the heart words of falsehood, and judgment is turned away backward. Look at how much this chapter is about judgment. Corruption among judges, among lawyers, among rulers. Justice stands far off, it says, for truth is fallen in the street, and equity cannot enter. That's really what this is a fight over. The truth. The laws of the land. Laws that were based, so many of them, on biblical principles. As acknowledged by some of America's justices of old. Verse 15 says, yes, truth fails, and he that departs from evil makes himself a prey. And the Lord saw it, and it displeased him, and there was no judgment. Well, there's quite a lot that you can take away from that chapter. Quite a lot that you can study in Isaiah 59, in Micah 3. Going back to what we touched on in the first segment, all through the book of Micah, in fact, Habakkuk 1. Let me just conclude with an article written by a historian here in the UK, Paul Johnson. This is a relatively old essay. It's referred to in No Freedom Without Law, my father's booklet. And Mr. Johnson writes, this is from December 1999, about, and my father brought some of this out in that program 7 years ago, how that we have to be prepared to die to uphold the law of the land. Just to paraphrase some of the thoughts in there. And then picking it up here in the midst of this quote, it says, the essence of the rule of law is its impersonality, omnipotence, and ubiquity. It is the same law for everyone, everywhere. Kings, emperors, high priests, the state itself are subject to it. If exceptions are made, the rule of law begins to collapse. That was the grand lesson of antiquity. That was the lesson of Rome. That's the lesson of the Greco-Macedonian Empire. That's the grand lesson of history. Have we learned from that lesson? Has America learned from that lesson? Johnson says both in Virginia and in New England to the north, the colonists were determined, God-fearing men, often in search of a religious toleration denied them at home, who brought their families and were anxious to farm and establish permanent settlements. They put political and religious freedom before riches. They put political and religious freedom before riches, he says. Thus took shape the economic dynamo that eventually became the United States, an experiment designed to establish the rule of God on earth. What a noble goal these pioneers had. They really did aim to observe the laws of the land, to submit to the laws of the land. How many Americans today, how many leaders in America today look upon the law in this way? Or in the way that President George Washington did when he said the foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality. Character counts, in other words. He said of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. What we believe, these laws that were drawn based on Bible principles, that's what it all stands on. That's what it's all built upon. Just to finish here in Isaiah, verse 18, it says, according to their deeds, according he will repay fury to his adversaries, but there is hope. There is hope, as the end of this passage brings out. This is Isaiah 59, verse 20. And the Redeemer shall come to Zion, and unto them that turn from transgression in Jacob, says the Eternal. As for me, this is my covenant with them, says the Eternal. My spirit that is upon you, and my words which I have put in your mouth shall not depart out of your mouth, nor out of the mouth of your seed, nor out of the mouth of your seed seed, says the Eternal, from henceforth forever. Jesus Christ is returning to this earth, and soon, to establish God's rule of law on earth, to set up the kingdom of God on this earth, as it says in Revelation 11:15. The kingdom of God, which is the family of God, administering the law of God. That same law that God said to the kings of old. You write it down each day. You study it. You dig into it. You live by it. You serve God. And you serve the people of God. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily radio show on KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond. The live stream is available at the trumpet.com website and also the KPCG website as well. Send us those emails. Email us at td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.